This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
We actually trekked all the way up in the darkness, and we were only three people there. Not a sound except the wind around you. And you sit there and you see the Everest being lit up in the sunrise. And all around you is white capped mountains, blue sky. And in those 30 seconds, your life goes around you. You see your whole picture in 30 seconds. And I cried.
In this series of podcasts, I talk to people at the forefront of the creative industries about their life and work and their relationship with luxury. Vineet Bhatia is not an award-winning designer or the CEO of a luxury brand. No, he's a chef and restaurateur, the winner, in fact, of three Michelin stars for his extraordinary cuisine. Lauded by every food critic from Jonathan Meads to Michael Winner to Egon Rone, even the late and occasionally waspish A.A. Gill called him a super chef, the finest modern Indian chef anywhere. Well, welcome, Vineet.
Thank you.
Well lauded, clearly, by people who really do know what they're talking about when it comes to food. And I know you're about to open a restaurant here in Harrods, which sadly isn't opening till tomorrow. Otherwise, I could report on it. So tell me a little bit about Karma and where it's located.
Karma is our new little baby in London. It's in Harrods on the main dining floor, on the ground floor. This is the first time they have an Indian restaurant in 170-odd years. And it's a big refurb happening in the dining hall. So we are extremely proud, extremely honored and privileged to have showcasing our Indian cuisine here, something which I've strongly believed in. And for me, Harrods plays a very strong association because I have a small story. I came in the country in 1993. And you know, I came in because I should love aircrafts. And I purely came in to see Heathrow Airport. And I would watch Concorde landing every day from New York at 5 o'clock. The first building I stepped out of my restaurant to visit was Harrods, June 1993.
And why? Because it was so iconic.
It was so iconic. I had to come and see. So the first building I went to see, more than a palace, Buckingham Palace, was Harrods because close to me, I was the star of India. I walked into the door and in 20 seconds I walked out. I was so scared.
Oh no.
I could not believe the kind of luxury you saw here. And opulence, it just got me scared. I said, I don't fit in here. And I walked out. It took me courage in 2 weeks to come back and spend an hour looking around. And two things I saw. I saw the food hall and I went to the kids store, the toy store. And I just fell in love with it. So to come back here and to do a restaurant after 25 years, I think is pretty special.
It must be so exciting. And also, though, it's not the first time that your food has been available here in Harrods, though, is it? Because I think about a year ago, you started selling ready-made food in the food halls here.
We did. We did a small test run earlier, the small kiosk, where they launched the World Food Hall. And that's where we serve food on the go. So you can take wraps, you can take sandwiches, you can take biryanis, you can take kebabs, you can take samosas. You can either have it heated up or you can have it taken cold to your home like a takeaway and enjoy.
Oh, I'm starting to drool a little bit. I'm a bit peckish today, you know. Now, I'm glad that you mentioned your visit to London to look at Heathrow Airport because, as I understand it, you were born in Bombay.
Yes.
And you grew up very close to the airport in Bombay. In fact, so much so that you'd be deafened quite often by the landing of DC-10s, which were popular aircraft back then.
My morning wake-up call was 6:30 in the morning, Gulf Air DC-10 flying from Mumbai or Bombay to go to Bahrain. That was my wake-up call. And my brother and I used to cycle up and to go to the school through aerodrome. And I would watch the planes in awe. I should love engines. I love the sound. I love the smell. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to grow up and be a pilot. When I went for my exams for my defense services, I applied for Air Force. And I went for my interviews and I passed all my tests. And the medical, they failed me, saying, you're too short to be a pilot.
What? So how does size matter when you're a pilot?
That's what I asked. I said, it's all in the hands and the eyes. But apparently, they are foot pedals in an aircraft.
And was that pretty devastating for you? Because it
had
absolutely been your childhood dream.
I didn't know what to do. And then finally went into hotel school. Everybody laughed at me, say, you're going to work in hotels, you're going to clean toilets, you're going to do dishes, you're going to cut potatoes. And I said, yes. So I was a black sheep of the family. But when I went for my hotel training, I wanted to be a barman. And in Oberoi, in those days, there was a beautiful bar called the Lancers Bar. And I went for the interview. And the lady who interviewed me said, do you know what Lancers are? And I said, no. He said, they are 6 feet tall. You'd barely make to the bar counter. You can't put in a bar. So I said, I need to do some training. He said, only place you can go is the kitchen. So I was sent to the kitchen purely by error.
And Vineet, you've been discriminated against twice in your life because of your size. It is not very fair, is it really? But, of course, it did lead you by a sort of wayward path into what's become your passion. So at what point, having had the disappointment of not becoming a pilot or joining the Air Force, and then the disappointment of not fulfilling your aspiration to be a barman, at what point did you realize that actually you had a passion for food?
It was in 86 when I went to do my internship at the Oberoi's.
Is this still in Bombay?
This is still in Bombay. And I walked in the kitchen in the morning at 6:30 and I was absolutely amazed to see absolutely immaculate, clean kitchen, very disciplined. So you walk in there, they check your nails, they check your uniform, they check your hair, they check your hand, they check your shoes. And if you are not dressed, you send back. And I just love discipline. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to learn to cook. And in those days, nobody went into Indian kitchen. Everybody wanted to learn French cuisine or Chinese or pastry. I opted for Indian because that's something which I understood. So I was a very, very few chefs in those days who actually took up the challenge of learning proper Indian cuisine, the classics, and how it's supposed to be done.
And how did you learn that at the Oberoi? Did they have anyone who specialized in Indian food at the time? Because the thing in those days, wasn't it, was you went to a big hotel, you ate international food, exactly. No matter how despicable it was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I did 3 months nonstop, 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. I wanted to learn. I was selfish. I was greedy. I wanted the knowledge. So literally from a 500-bedroom hotel, I started doing breakfast service. In a matter of 3 weeks' time, I was making omelets. And that is how I grasped my knowledge.
But was your initial training in, you know, as I say, sort of international, you're talking about within 3 weeks you were making omelets. So were you at first very much focused because of what was required of you on learning how to make sort of basic French food, basic English food, you know, so on and so forth? Where did the passion for recreating your own food come from?
We had good food at home. We had luxurious food. We had very simple. When I went to the hotel, it opened my eyes to see how things can be done or how things change when you're cooking for a larger audience. And I always knew from day one, I want to do specifically Indian cuisine. Although I had to learn international food, Chinese food, my heart was into Indian. But what I did, I learned the basics of different cuisines. And if you look at cuisines from around the world, the basics are almost similar. The flavorings change, the spicing change. The technique is the same. The Chinese smoke food, we smoke food, the French smoke food, the sweet smoked food. It's what you add in spices. So I use the same technique, but I add my spices on them and enhance flavors. India is all about flavors.
Well, that's one of the things that's so fascinating about the food you make. I mean, there's pretty extraordinary things, you know, chocolate pasta. Tell me a bit about where you found, because also India is huge, mm-hmm. and there's many, many different kinds of cuisine. So is yours a sort of symphony of all of those areas pulled together, or would you describe yours as being particularly of a region?
It is pan-Indian. I think I cook from my heart and I cook from my mind. That's the way I put food down. You can't pigeonhole and say the food comes from North India or from South India. We do a chicken tikka, which is North Indian, but we infuse that with, say, ginger and curry leaf from South India or the mustard seeds, which is predominant there. So we try and do a blend. And we call in our language jugalbandi, which means a harmony. So it's a harmony of flavors you put together onto a plate. But you can only do that if you understand the basics well. And I left India because I wasn't allowed to create or innovate. Whereas the French chefs were allowed to do that, but as an Indian, you can't change it. It's not broken, so don't change it. You can't serve expensive ingredients, supposed to be cheap. And I rebelled. I said, if I see a European chef doing it, and I actually told my chefs off, I said, you people are hypocrites. You applaud them for creativity, but when it comes to your own food, you let us down. And I knew I had to leave. And that's why I left and I came to London. So when I came to UK, I realized that what you're being served in the UK is not really Indian cuisine.
Well, I did want to ask you about that because I also came to London, you know, at the very beginning of the 1980s. And to get an Indian, I lived in West London. You used to go down Westbourne Grove and there was a whole row of them. The Standard had very good butter chicken.
Yes.
Khan's had a beautiful room, sort of colonial kind of style with hand-painted walls and things. But actually the food, you know, Indian food was what you ate on a Friday night when you'd had too much to drink and it sort of filled the gap and it was quite spicy and it did the trick.
What it did was you were playing stomach gladiators. You had 6 pints of beer, then you had 6 papadams, mango chutney, onion bhaji, chicken tikka, and you had a vindaloo, and next morning you cry. What have I done?
But mostly it was because of the pints of beer, I think, that made you cry.
Yeah.
But so were you, because I don't know what the food in India was like at that time, were you shocked by what you found in the UK went under the label of Indian food?
I was shocked. When I actually came in the country, I landed on May 30th, 1993, I still had 45 days of my holiday period as notice. And it did come to my mind, do I go back to India? Because, you know, you leave a luxury 5-star hotel where you have valet services and chauffeurs around you and you have the best butlers being looking after your guests and you can source products and you come to London and you say, hang on, I was the only Indian in the Indian restaurant and the food being served there was nothing to do with India. I really got shocked. And then I realized either I change it or I go back. And I like to fight. As a kid, being the smallest and the shortest, I learned to look after myself well. So I knew what I had to do. The first thing I did, I cleaned the entire kitchen, got them proper uniforms, and I said, now we start training them. Get them uniform, get them hats, make them understand what a restaurant is about. And the very first dish I made was a dessert, and I gave it to a guest. And the guest sent it back saying, this is not Indian. It was a carrot fudge, slow-cooked carrot fudge. So I went up to see the guest, and he said, you are too young to be a chef. And he said, a carrot halwa should be served ice cold into a cube in a bowl. And I was scratching my head, you never serve a fudge which is cooked in fat cold. You're eating pure fat cold. But that is what they were doing. They were buying it from the shops outside, cutting into a cube, putting it into a white bowl and giving it to a guest. And unfortunately, the English were lapping it up.
So you started out, was your first job on the Fulham Road?
It was in Old Brompton Road, a place called Star of India. God bless them. I mean, they were one of the oldest Indian restaurants in the UK. Sadly, they closed a year back. But that is where I began my career in the country, and I can't thank them enough. So 5 years I was with them. And in 5 years, I think the restaurant got all the accolades any chef could desire. That place got some glorious reviews from A.A. Gill and Faye Mashler, and that changed everything. They expose your cuisine within London, and the London market is massive. There are 3,500 Indian restaurants. What makes you different from everybody else? And that's what we did. We cooked food which was probably in the finest form and served very elegantly. I think that was the only Indian restaurant which had a waiting list for 2 months. And in lunch, you could not get a table. And, you know, it was fantastic. But I wasn't growing as a chef. I needed to move on. And that is when I moved off and opened Zaika. And Zaika was a game changer. Because that is where we got the Michelin star in 2001.
And really, you single-handedly revolutionized what British people's concept of Indian food was and could be. Did you have an ambition? Were you thinking about things like a Michelin star, or were you just focused on food?
When I came in 93, there was no Google, there was no internet, there was no search engines, nothing as such. I didn't even know what a Michelin star was. I had no clue. I learned it when I came in here. And it's a very funny story. We used to have a gentleman used to come to Star of India for takeaway 3 times a week. You know, when somebody comes for so often over months, you get very intrigued, you want to see him. All that kitchen order said was Mr. White, one butter chicken, one lamb shish kebab, one bread or whatever, and the same thing every time. So I finally went up one day with the takeaway brown bag, and Mr. White came in and I gave it to him. I said, I wanted to thank you for coming so often. And he said, hi, my name is Marco. And I said, thank you, Mr. White, nice meeting you. And that was it. He went off. A few weeks later, on the Evening Standard, there was a whole thing which splashed. It came out that Marco P. White has got 3 Michelin stars. And I saw the photograph. I said, I know this guy. And I said, he comes for takeaway all the time. And that is how I got to know Marco. And Marco is a very dear friend now. So I've known Marco for almost 25 years. And I've been feeding him. So that is how I came introduced to Michelin. And Marco in those days said, stick to what you do. You will get a star. And then it was so funny because in 2001, I still remember on the 19th of Jan, at 7 in the morning, I had a phone call. And a lady came on the phone with an American accent and said, said, "Is that Chef Vineet?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "I wanted to ask you, how do you feel on getting the Michelin star?" And I said, "Ma'am, it's 7 in the morning, please." And I put the phone down. And she called back and she said, it's not a prank call. I genuinely want to ask you, I'm calling from New York Times. I have a press release in the front of me which says, you're the first Indian chef to have got the Michelin star. How do you feel?" I said, "I have no idea. But thank you for letting me know." And that was the end of the story.
How did you feel there?
I cried.
Really?
I can feel that. Because that changed everything for me. That changed my life. And 2004 is when we actually left Zaika and we opened our own place in Chelsea in Sloane Square called Rasoi, which means a kitchen. And that was 100% us. By us, I mean my wife and I.
Where did you meet your wife?
Oh, it was a very odd story. It was an arranged marriage through a newspaper, a matrimonial section on every Sunday. So it was her parents had put an ad out, 50 words in the small slot. And my father saw the ad. He replied. And then the parents met. And they said, yeah, this could probably work. And then I was in London. So I went back on a break in 97. And we met, and that was it.
So you'd been here how long?
I had been here on your own. For 4 years, 4.5 years.
So it was very good arranged marriage, though, because you're mad about each other, aren't you?
Well, I think so we are, yes. At least I am.
Wait, you're not so sure about her side?
No, I am. I'm 100% sure. It's been 21 years, 22 years, in fact.
There must have been, there must be other Indian chefs who have aspirations and dreams of making haute cuisine rather than, Friday night pint food. Sure. What do you think it was about your food, your ethos, that ensured that you've become so successful? I mean, now you have restaurants in some of the greatest hotels in the world, spread around the Middle East, also in Switzerland.
Mumbai.
Yeah, in Mumbai. In fact, you've got a restaurant, haven't you, back in the very same place where you trained.
I did. When I trained back in 85, 86 in Bombay. So when the hotel went for a refurb, Mr. Oberoi actually asked us to come back for a meeting. And I walked in there and they had a file which was almost a foot wide. And they said, this is you in the past 25 years. We have all the track record right from your college days to Oberoi school days to here. He said, why should I get you here to do my restaurant? And I turned back and told Mr. Oberoi, you have been a pioneer, a maverick in the hotel field. That's what you have done. That is what I am with Indian food. If you want me to come back and make a black dal and butter chicken and chicken tikka, I'm not your man. But if you want me to come back and make you chocolate samosas and you want me to make you a tomato butter ice cream, I'm the person right for you. And that is how I got that contract.
That's incredible, though, that they'd kept track of everything
they had
you were doing as well.
And Mr. Oberoi then actually said a word which none of us thought of. He said, the prodigal son returns. And that was incredible. It nailed it.
And how, why do you think attitudes to Indian food were so bad, really? Because we were eating what we thought was Indian food. But even in India itself, the idea of an elevated Indian cuisine, I mean, I bet even in the fancy houses in Bombay at that time, people were eating French food, weren't they? If they were rich, they were eating, European food.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they don't consider their own food avant-garde, for example. The classic thing with Indian food is you douse them with too many spices and too many masalas and you try and cook with it. You know, it tastes nice. But when you're buying a good piece of fish or you're buying a good piece of lobster or a prawn or a lamb chop, you must taste the protein because that's what you're paying for. You're not paying for the spice. Unfortunately, 99% of Indian restaurants around the world will buy a very poor product. And to camouflage that, you will kill them with spices. You don't taste anything else. But with us, we reverse thinking. We use the sauce as a flavoring, but the core flavor of a lobster remains lobster. You taste the lobster. You taste the lamb chop. You taste the confit chicken. You must taste that. Spices only enhance flavors. They shouldn't camouflage flavors. Your sourcing is very important. Ethical sourcing is very important. Especially now with Karma here, we keep everything within the UK boundaries. So everything comes from within the land here. Very, very few things are actually imported, except spices. We want to be very much focused on British farming. You got to support the farmers here. So we are very careful about those things. We try and keep our carbon footprint down as much as we can.
And how much would you say your food is a fusion of you know, influences? And how much is it? I mean, it's not traditional Indian food, but is it still faithful to Indian cookery? What makes it Indian? You know, when, if you're talking about a chocolate samosa, you know, what makes that an Indian dish? Aside from the fact that a samosa is obviously Indian.
If you eat my food with your eyes closed, it's India on your palate. But if you open your eyes and eat your food, it's international. It could be in the finest French restaurant, but the flavors are all of India.
So why is that?
It's because I wanted to make a statement. Because when I came in the country in 93, I was so put off and I told off that this is the curry house. It has to be £5 and a beer. It has to be cheap. You know, Indian food is not about that. There are elements of luxury in India. It is a land of milk and honey. You go to royal houses, they still eat food on golden plates, golden spoons. Literally, they still do that. There is luxury. But people here don't see it. They think it's a land of snake charmers and elephants. That's not a fact. There's a lot more depth in India. The story goes on for almost 5,000-6,000 years. It's steeped in culture. Everybody has come to India. And India got influenced by so many things around us. The Mughals came in. The Chinese came in. The British came in. The Dutch came in. The French came in. They've all come in and they've actually added off things to Indian cuisine. So if you look at the food from India, what we eat now, your biryani, your kebab, your samosas, are not really Indian. They come from Persia. The spices come from Persia. But India has adapted that. And I always thought, as a young chef who hasn't traveled much but learned the basics well, I used to question, because I had a very thinking mind. I had a very questioning mind. Why do you add so much oil? Why do you add so much of fat? Why do you add so much of spice? Because everything is so camouflaged. So I used to start taking things out. Only put things which are required for the dish. And not required, out they go. Try and clean the cuisine. And when I came to start off in 93, when I started doing my food, was very classic in those days, was told off by the Brits because they didn't understand that. So I couldn't call a Rogan Josh or Rogan Josh, because a Rogan Josh in those days had an inch of oil on top, had peppers in them, onions and tomatoes, which you never add in Rogan Josh.
I've eaten that.
You know, from those days, so what do? I had to survive. So I would not call my dish a Rogan Josh or Rogan Josh. I would not call carrot halwa a carrot halwa, but the Rogan Josh became a slow-cooked leg of lamb with Kashmiri spices served with saffron pulao. It's basically Rogan Josh. And they enjoyed that. So my gajar halwa became a slow-cooked carrot fudge with pistachio and saffron and honey. And they enjoyed that. I was right there warm, not served cold.
Clearly struggling against the odds when you first came here.
I still am.
Well, do you feel that you still are?
Yeah, I still am. I think you always have the stigma of Indian cuisine. And that's why when Harrods
happened. Still?
Yes, you still feel that. I still feel that. I still have an unfinished business to do. I still feel that. I still have the burning desire to take the next step forward and make it better. Now, when Harrods came to us here to do the restaurant here, I had to take it up. Because in Chelsea, I was trying to get people from around the world to come to a small unit to expose Indian cuisine. But here at Harrods, the world comes to you. You cannot get a better platform to showcase Indian cuisine at a better address than Harrods. It is so iconic.
And how do you start creating a new recipe? Does it start on paper? Do you start just putting ingredients together? How does it work?
I still carry a notepad when I'm at work, a small little pocketbook. And I also keep a bedside book, small book, where I actually put my food flashes at 3-4 in the morning. I actually write them down.
Or do you wake up in the middle of the night?
I do.
Do you call them food flashes?
Food flashes, yes. I still do. I still make notes and I get up and it's all a scribble like earthworms. And you're trying to understand, what did you write at night? It still happens. Inspiration comes from things all around you. You just need to open your mind. And you need to be observant. And you got to think outside the box. That's what I've always done. But I keep my heart and soul very Indian. So if I go to Venezuela or I go to somewhere else or to Japan, I will look at things around me and I'll try and take elements. What can work with spices? What works with flavors? What things can work together? I can actually close my eyes and I can taste food. So if I close my eyes, I can taste saffron if I have to. I can taste cardamom or roasted cumin if I want to. A normal chef probably can't.
So you can imagine what they're going to taste like combined to a degree.
Yes.
And then you test it.
And then you test it. And then you actually draw it out. You sketch, you write a dish down and you try and work it into a plate. And that is how is the first basic composition of your menu. It's like a musical note. And then you start composing a menu based on that. There have to be peaks and troughs. There have to be little intensity. There have to be softness. There has to be temperatures. There have to be sounds. So when you talk of eating, is very sensual. So all your senses also have to get activated. So you say, you hear food. You say, oh, how do you hear food? Well, you do when you have a piece of crisp paper, when it cracks, the sound gets you going and that makes you salivate. And that is a process you have to understand.
Does your wife cook at home?
Yes, she does. We both cook at home.
So who cooks the most at home?
She. Most of the time is her.
And what is her food influenced by yours, or does she have her own style?
She has her own style. She has her own style, and she makes the best yellow lentils.
And I love yellow.
A roti, which is a flatbread, and that's my favorite. Thin flatbread, yellow lentils, and a bowl of dal. For me, that is heaven.
Now, I've asked you to bring along a luxury item today, something that's really precious to you. And it's not a saucepan, I can see that. Or a knife.
No. Nope.
So tell me what you've brought.
I've got these beads with me, and I got these beads from Nepal. These are called Rudrashk.
They look like little brown, I don't know, seeds.
They look like nutmeg.
Nutmeg, exactly.
They look like nutmeg. Yes. They have different grooves in them. The most precious ones have got a single groove. And they're phenomenally expensive. This has got five. And this was given to me by the priest of the Pashupati temple in Kathmandu.
And I know I'm being really stupid, but what are they?
They are seeds.
They're seeds?
They are seeds.
So they grow on a tree?
Yeah, and they fall. And they collect them.
And where do they grow?
They grow in the plains of the Ganges, by the sacred river, just on the foothills of the Himalayas. They are extremely rare to get. And they all vary from place to place. They actually give you a lot of energy. I've been very lucky. I got a whole little garland full of these. I also have got small miniature versions. And I got that in Nepal last year because I went to Mount Everest. It was my 50th. And I said, I need to give something back. And there's a charity in India we support called the Heart for India Foundation, where we have 3,000 girl child. We will look after them right from they're born till they're 18 and they get to the world. So I actually trekked for 15 days to go to Everest Base Camp. And we set up a restaurant there for the first time ever for 3 days.
But they've never had a restaurant then.
No,
why would you? Who wants to carry all that stuff?
So people have flown to the base camp, cook for half an hour and come off because of the low oxygen level. We said, no, we will fly in up to Kathmandu and we trek for 15 days all the way till we reach 17,800 feet. And we set up a restaurant for 3 days, all for charity. All the money which we earned there, we gave it to the girl child and to the Nepalese earthquake victims. And this is what I carried with me. So that has been my energy and my source. And there's also a place I went up to before the base camp is called Kala Pathar, which is Blackstone. And that's a place where you actually get to see Mount Everest during sunrise and sunset. And it is incredible. So we were told you're going to leave in the morning at 2:30 and you're going to climb for 400 meters. It took us 5 hours for 400 meters.
Just because of the air.
It's a very steep climb.
Yeah.
And literally, you take three steps and you pant and you stop.
Yeah.
Because oxygen level is literally 42%, 45%. So myself and a camera crew and a sound crew, we actually trekked all the way up in the darkness. We got there to see there. And I had my mala with me, my garland. And we were only three people there. Not a sound except the wind around you. And you sit there and you see the Everest being lit up in the sunrise. And all around you is white cap mountains, blue sky. And in those 30 seconds, your life goes around you. What you have done is like a movie. You see your whole picture in 30 seconds. And I cried. You get so emotionally charged with what you see there. And it makes you wonder, what are you doing in life? And this is why I carry this with me all the time. It's my traveling companion.
That's the most amazing description.
No, it is special.
Of seeing Everest.
So when I was trekking in the mountains, you know, you're doing almost 11 hours of trek every day. And you get tired and your brain goes haywire, you're wondering. So this was my traveling companion. So it keeps you. People eat gum or they have yak cheese. I used to have Bounty, a cereal bar and Bounty all the time. And I just kept the beads in my hand. And I was so lucky because my elder son also trekked with me. And he was just 19 when he came along. So it was a family, like a father and son bonding together on a 15-day trek. And all for a cause.
It sounds like an amazing trip. Just finally, I mean, obviously, when you come to Harrods, you have to go and check out Karma. Yes. And see how things are going there. But if you could wander any other part of the building, part of the store, where would you go? Would it still be? I know you said when you first came, it was the food halls and the toy shop. Do you still go there?
Yes. But where I would love to spend more time is the watch rooms. I love watches.
Do you collect them or just look at them?
I do collect watches.
So what's your top favorite?
Hublot. Anyone Hublot is fine. I don't need Hublot. It's just something about the design, the lines around it, the way it's structured, the way it looks. It is. I used to buy Breitling earlier. But what a Hublot, I fell in love with it. So for me, Hublot is the best one.
So now that, I mean, you know, your food is served in restaurants, in luxury hotels across the world, and now you're here at Harrods, the sort of home of luxury with Karma. Do you think that you've managed to achieve the goal of representing Indian food as one of life's great luxuries?
It is. Harrods is so iconic. It is all about luxury. And, you know, we're just very honored and privileged to be here to showcase Indian cuisine at the finest location probably anywhere in the world.
And do you think people now see, you know, we used to see Indian food, like you and I talked about, as something to have on a Friday night, certainly not a luxury. Do you think now that people's minds have changed and it is seen as a luxury to go to a great Indian restaurant and eat great Indian food? Do you think people understand the difference?
No, they do. Now they do, yes. I mean, when they talk of going out to eat or taking a corporate guest or very special occasions, they would think of an Indian restaurant for sure. And I'm glad it's mine. In some ways, we have changed the whole mindset of people in this country and around the world of what Indian food can be. You expose food to the finest level. And that's where I think our forte lies. And that's where we'll continue to do. And no better place than Karma at Harrods. It can't be better than that.
Well, I hope you're going to keep me a table there because you've made me so hungry. I can't tell.
Come for the chocolate samosas.
Don't have to ask twice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vineet Bhatia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Vineet Bhatia. Next week, I meet the designers Levi Palmer and Matthew Harding, who, as Palmer Harding, make what are reputed to be the best shirts in the world. And that's despite having started their company in Matthew's parents' house in Walthamstow. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.